Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Along Came a Writer Network. Opinions expressed in our shows do not necessarily reflect those of the network.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Coffee, Tea, and Thee with our guest today, Hattie O. Arnold. My name is Linda Kozar, and I'm an author podcaster. And this show, I like to have guests on who share the story of their life, how they got to the place they are now, whether the story, some of the stories are sad or touching, bittersweet, funny, and they're often miraculous. And everyone has a story to tell, and I want to hear them all. How about you? Today, our guest is Henry O. Arnold. He co-authored the novel Hometown Favorite with Bill Barton, and a work of nonfiction, Cobble 24, with Ben Pearson. He co-wrote and produced with Steve Taylor and Ben Pearson the film The Second Chance, starring Michael W. Smith, love him. He wrote the screenplay for the documentary on evangelist Billy Graham, God's Ambassador, and the documentary Cobble 24, based on the book. His latest documentary film, Go to the Rock, The Gospel Roots of Whitney Houston, will be released in 2023. Can't wait for that. The Singer of Israel is the third volume in his historical fiction series, The Song of Prophets and Kings. The first two volumes, The Voice Within the Flame and The Crown of the Warrior King, are also published by Whitefire Publishing. He lives on a farm in Tennessee with his lovely wife, Kay. They have two beautiful daughters married to two handsome men with three above-average grandchildren. For more information, go to henryoarnold.com. Welcome to the show, Henry.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah, let's emphasize that above-average grandchildren.
Well, of course. nothing less.
Yes, how can we not?
So we were chatting a little bit before the show, and we're going to talk about how Henry got started, his early life, and then whatever he wants to share in, well, we have 27 minutes to talk about his life and his books. So we're going to talk about his life first and then gravitate toward the books.
Well, thank you, Linda, for having me on the show and giving me a chance to have this conversation with you. It's wonderful. I guess I come from a family that's theatrical, and not only in profession, but also just in a way of life. It's an artistic way of life. It's almost like you have to audition in order to come to dinner. And if you don't come in on 10, then you can get, easily overwhelmed. My family, I have three other siblings, and we just grew up in a very lively household. And my dad was also a worship minister, a worship leader. And so with all of that, we had people over the house all the time, from missionaries and actors and artists. And it was just a good time. But there was an emphasis on two things, and that was, our church life or our walk of faith and the artistic life. And the first play I saw was my father playing the role of Billy Bigelow in Carousel, the musical Carousel. And I was, 3 or 4 years old, and if you don't know the story, the character of Bigelow, he dies by a self-inflicted wound, and it was traumatizing to me to see my dad. I didn't obviously have the understanding of, hey, this is a play, seeing my father, die on stage in front of hundreds of people, I lost it. My uncle had to carry me out of the theater. So
that would be rough.
I did not react quietly.
And then you became a theater kid after that moment.
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of the way it was. I ended up just performing with my father quite frequently in various projects. but and also my mom. And I would come home from on summers at school in Pepperdine. I was at a Pepperdine University in my undergraduate work, and in order to help pay for tuition, we would work at a dinner theater, and the tips we made, I would just give to my mother at the end of every night, and we used that. She'd write a check to tuition at the end of the run of a play. So it was,
that's great.
You know, we were all kind of in this together, and all the life I've been in, you know, I've been doing it for well over 50 years now. And the first professional show I really did was in 1970 with my father, who played Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. So that was the real turning point in my life at that time that, you know, kind of solidified, okay, this is what I think I'm called to do. Even though at the time, at 20 years old, I didn't recognize it so much as a calling as much as this was, I had a little bit of talent in this area. And
can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
What is the funniest thing or the wildest thing that happened during a performance? You know, I mean, I can imagine in a dinner theater, I mean, all sorts of things could happen.
Right.
All
sorts of things can happen, but or a regular. I guess the first thing that, there's probably so many. I'll tell you one funny and then one terrifying. One, there was a theater company that created a series of stories around Aesop's fables and the Grimm's fairy tales. It's called Story Theater, so it's a collection of those tales. And I played the Hound in. The Bremerton Musicians, and I was coming out on stage on all fours, and as soon as I opened my mouth, I started to hiccup, and I am hiccuping about every 10 seconds, and so I'm thinking about, I can't stop the hiccups, so how now can I use the hiccups as a dog, as the hound, and say the lines I need to say and howl when I need to howl. And so, you know, that was a funny moment. And of course the other actors who played the rooster and the cat and the donkey are looking at me going, I think Arnold has lost his mind.
Well, you know, I have a friend who passed to glory, but well, she used to act in plays, and we would, as friends, would go to support her. So one time we decided, stopped up at a resale shop, and we saw these old band hats. So we bought band hats, all matching, and we sat there in the audience and until they noticed us, and the whole cast was having a hard time.
Right. See, the thing about it is, they shouldn't be laughing at you. You should be laughing at them. So.
Yes. But thanks for sharing that story about the hiccuping hound.
Yeah, the hiccuping hound. That's a great. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah.
I'll write about that at some time. The hiccuping hound. That's a great title.
So, you always write those titles down. Next, you moved on. I mean, you were in college. And what was your major?
It was theater and acting. So I got an undergraduate degree at Pepperdine University in theater. And then I went from there to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where they had an MFA program, a two-year conservatory program, where you really dove deep into the craft of acting. And so you were, I mean, you had intensive classes and theatrical, how to create character and all the scene work that you did. And then you had extra, I wouldn't say extracurricular because it was part of the curriculum, but I took fencing, I took folk dancing, I took dialect coaching, I took, you know, all the kinds of things that prepare you as an actor to go out into the world. And they didn't tell me how to put a resume together. They didn't do that. But you had to learn that on your own. But if you did get, you know, an opportunity to audition, how to prepare for an audition, how to, if you got the role, then how to prepare for the role. And, you know, just all of that in 2 years of very intensive training. And I was doing, you know, professional work in and around that time. But once I graduated in 76 from that program, then it was just the rest of the time, the rest of my life, I've been doing that. So,
bicentennial.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was working at Opryland USA at the time doing a song. I was a song and dance man. So, you know, and that, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. I mean, and yeah. So what caused the, well, I mean, it seems like they're related, you know, writing books and also, you know, writing screenplays or
right.
You know, editing. It's all the, you know, in the realm of creatives. And so
right.
What prompted you to move into the writing realm?
I think it's the love of language. And that's, you know, that is the common bond between all, whether you're speaking the language or you're writing the language, whatever form it should take. There is this common, I guess I fell in love with language, being able to, you know, say words of playwrights that, you know, from Shakespeare to Arthur Miller to Tennessee Williams to even contemporary playwrights, all of that is in the service of telling a story. And so I felt like I was familiar with, you know, language, and that I could, and I was familiar with the art of storytelling. So I felt like, all right, I feel like I've got this extra, I guess you could say, extra gift or talent from the Lord, that I, not only can I act a character and tell a story that way, I can also write, you know, put a story together on paper. And it began with some plays, some musicals. There was a theater company that I helped form in Nashville called Nightingale Theater with two other people, and so mm-hmm. we would do original works, and I did that from 80 to 81 to 85, and so I would write the book versions of the musicals, and this couple would write the music, and we would do an original musical. You know, we probably did three or four together. And then eventually I moved from there to doing one-man shows on biblical characters, Jesus, Paul, and King David. And it was during that time, and I would go out on the road and perform. I actually went out with Michael W. in the mid-90s and when he did his acoustic tour. And I opened his show with my one-man show on Jesus, the Word made flesh. And so it was just, I guess you could say, a natural professional evolution of acting and speaking language to writing and telling story that through theater to the writing. And that was from plays, one-man shows, plays, to screenplays, to now these novels.
Do you find that when you're writing a book, you go to theater when you're, because you can be pretty dialogue heavily, you know,
right.
Heavy if you're doing that. But do you find yourself thinking of the setting? Because, you know, some people writers have a problem with just doing too much dialogue and not enough setting. Others
right.
have too much
right.
setting, you know, and,
right.
and balancing those.
It is. I mean, it's. Of course, the theater, when you're doing the play, you have the luxury of being on stage with other actors and listening to them, and actually through the rehearsal process, you're creating characters together. and telling this one story, and each one is contributing. In a sense, it's the same way with, and of course you have lights and sound and sets and all that that give you a sense of place and time, gives the audience a sense of place and time where the story is happening.
It's the same thing
with a novel, writing a novel. You're giving a sense of place and time to a reader that you hope takes them away from their present life. You know, if they're riding the subway to work, or if they're, you know, in their comfortable chair at home, or wherever they are reading a book, you hope that the story is spiriting them away in their imagination from where they are at the present moment. And that requires the ability to set a time and place of your story, give characters that are interesting and at the same time accessible to a reader. They understand, oh, I know this person. I understand this person. I like this person, or I don't like this person, but I like them enough to, and I'm intrigued enough to follow where they're going. So
even if you're a villain, they want to know what that
even
villain
if
is
you're a
next.
Villain. Yeah, yes. Right. And you've got to be, you know, you've got to be true to who all these characters are, because if you start, you know, if you start doing what, messing with a reader by not giving them enough information or just enough that they need to get a hook into the story and in these characters, then you're cheating. I think a reader will quickly close the book.
Well, you know, this is a good segue into the writing part, because I was thinking of, Crown of the Warrior King is the story of Saul, right?
Right. Right.
That one. And so he's, you know, he starts off sort of, and things go wrong.
Yeah, he starts off pretty good.
He goes cray cray, you know.
Right.
And was it, I mean, so do you feel like after researching and writing about him that you, you know, have some sort of psychological analysis of what went on in him to, you know, move him to that position? As a rebel, against him.
Right, absolutely, and I'm, you know, of course, he comes into his kingship. It's almost like he's blindsided, because he's not, you know, he's not looking out to be a king.
Well, no.
He's on a journey to get the livestock that his father lost. And he bumps into the prophet Samuel, and Samuel says, "You are, you know, Yahweh has chosen you." And he goes, "What?" It's that kind of thing, And so he's not looking for the gig of being king, and you know that's we actually meet Saul in the first book. A voice within the flame, where this very thing that I just mentioned is described more in detail,
and that's the story of Samuel, right, or Hannah?
Yes, right.
Yeah,
right. Samuel with Hannah, his mom, and Elkanah, his father, and the love story of this, you know, this of his parents' love story. And then moving, you know, watching Samuel grow and mature, and then eventually come back home and meet his future wife, Shira, who is totally made out of whole cloth. There's no mention of her at all in 1st or 2nd Samuel. And but he had to have a wife, or they wouldn't have had two sons. But and they are definitely mentioned. So
yeah.
I move into that love story between Samuel and Shira, and their whole relationship that continues from novel to novel, and they are an anchor, even though other prophets show up, like Gad and Nathan. So Samuel, back to your original question. I'm sorry I digressed there, but Saul I take literary license in some regards to try and understand myself why Saul would make choices that he makes that we know in Scripture that begin what you would call his downfall. And it's a tragic, I mean, Saul, the character of Saul, is a true, in the Greek sense of the word, is a true tragic character. And and how did that happen? And it can't just be by one or two choices. There have to be somewhere in his makeup that he falls prey to pride or hubris, all of, you know, which is we're all susceptible to. And and then once that takes over the choices, the people that come into your life, you begin to mistrust them and be jealous of them, like he was of David, and you know, and it's there's that snowball effect. But it starts with those little seeds of doubt that you plant in your own, or are planted in your own heart, that turn to bad choices, that those choices lead to, okay, I can't trust myself anymore, I can't trust anybody else around me, and, you know, from God to Samuel to his children to this new kid that comes in, David, and kills a giant, and, you know, I hope I approach the character of Saul in a way that shows not just villainy, but a real empathy for how human we all are.
Yes.
And then we are all human, and then how that hubris begins to eat away at our heart, and we're incapable or we refuse to pull back from that. And
well,
it just takes a slippery slope.
This segues you also into the singer of Israel, which is David. And you think of David, who was at Saul's dinner parties at the palace. And he's like, oh, play the harp for me. And, you know, now that's a performance where, you know, you had to be on the edge of your seat because you knew that a sword was going to...
Right.
You know, at some point, Saul was going to, you know, launch a spear at you.
A spear,
you know,
yeah.
Like, ooh,
right.
You know. Hmm.
Yeah, ooh. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, is it my plane? Is it the song?
Yeah, right. You know, I've felt like I've given bad performances before, but they weren't worth, you know, getting a spear thrown at you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's on the edge of your seat kind of performance there. So.
Right.
But the Singer of Israel is your latest. It's the third. Are there going to be more in the series?
This is the Song of Prophets and Kings will be a quintet of novels. So I have finished the fourth one and turned that one in, and I haven't even written the first sentence of volume five. So I've got some other things that I've got to do before I can get to that one, but volume four is done, and there will be a fifth one, and that will end the series.
Until your next series.
Yeah.
Until the next
or,
one.
Or, you know, my wife says, enough.
So, let's see. Yes, I mean, we know what's coming down the line with that, but what about, acting or screenwriting or playwriting?
Yeah. Well,
projects.
Of course, The Singer of Israel comes out November 15th. And this year has been, I'll get back to that in a minute, but I have done this summer, I did a production of The Hiding Place, which was a new original adaptation of The Hiding Place, Corrie ten Boom's story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big success, and they've filmed the stage production, and it will be released in theaters sometime in 2023. So I played a couple of different roles in that.
I remember the original movie.
Yes.
The Hiding Place.
Oh yeah, yeah, right. Well, this was the original movie was I can't remember the two ladies. Jeanette Clift George one,
right.
And Julie Harris, I think, was the other.
Julie Harris.
Nothing like this has been done since then. That was a Billy Graham feature film, and the Billy Graham Association gave this theater company that I work for the rights to do this play and to film it. So this is kind of, 50 years later, or however many years, 40 years later.
It's high time.
Yeah, right. And it's a very powerful production. And then I also wrote this documentary screenplay for I Go to the Rock, The Gospel Roots of Whitney Houston. I got an email this week from the producer saying that the tentative release date is March 24th. So
I'm looking forward to that.
In the movie business, yeah, in the movie world, anything can happen. Just because they put a date on it does not mean it's in stone. So, but just look for that title. It's The Gospel Roots of Whitney Houston. And
I hope our
that will be out at some point.
And it's the same with the writing world, too. I mean, the date, that can change depending on things.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it's a long process, too. It's like, I finished the book last year, and it should be out in about 9 months. Or
right.
Maybe.
I know. It's kind of like it can be the gestation of a elephant, but you hope it's quicker than that, but still.
Yeah, and it's like, when's your book coming out? Well, soon, I hope.
I hope.
You have to be very patient with these things,
Right. You do. You have to be patient in the writing process. You have to be patient in the finding the agent and publisher process. And then once you find that commitment, you have to be patient in where the real work begins is the editing process and the rewrite process. As the song says, you can't hurry love. So you gotta be patient and enjoy every step of the way.
And you need a tough hide too.
Yeah.
for the editing process, because it's like, but I really like that, and you only play through the things.
I know.
You kind of like set your boundaries. Okay, I'll let that go, but I won't let this go.
Right.
Right.
Well, as I think William Faulkner said, once he finished writing a novel, he would have to, quote, start killing his darlings.
Yes.
End quote. And so, the things that you really like and you want to keep and don't want to let go of, those are probably the things you either let go of or you have to rewrite to the point to which you don't recognize it, what you originally had.
And I know, and you always think back on that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, I asked my last guest, Deb Rainey, do you have a favorite Christmas tradition with your family that you want to share, just something you do? Every year.
Wow, okay. Well, there's a lot of things that go on, but I will tell you this one that we did with our grandchildren. We always started, we live on a farm, and when they were, we still have them fooled at this point, although they are becoming agnostic when it comes to, all right, is this, is this really real or not? They're in the beginning of the question.
Yeah.
So we started this tradition many years ago, and the weekend of Thanksgiving, after we have our big Thanksgiving celebrations, we go back in the woods on the farm to pick up the Christmas tree that the Christmas tree fairies have left cut and ready to go for our grandchildren to find. I mean, we have to go back there in the woods. They have to find the Christmas tree. And so it's a, it can be, you know, it's not a big ordeal. We don't, but we don't make it easy, you know.
We go back on the
4x4 or whatever, and we look for the Christmas tree, and when we find it, we throw it in the back and drive back to the house, and we set it up and begin the decoration process. And so
until next year.
So that's really, we've done that now, I guess, for the last 7 or 8 years. And the kids just really enjoy getting out there and doing that. And that's a favorite one.
Well, thank you so much, Henry. We are completely out of time now. But I enjoyed it.
It went by so fast.
No, thank you. I mean, yes, it does go by fast. And I really appreciate just chatting with you about your life and about your book. And congratulations on your business. Yeah.
Thank you so much for this time and for being on your program. And you know, I just wish you all the best.
Well, thank you. And everybody, go visit henryoarnold.com. Take care.
And then by that time, it'll be... all the information will be up.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.